Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
An interesting program on this episode as we talk to Tom Gosch, a former executive with the Chicago Blitz indoor football team. He's going to tell us about the ins and outs and some of the great stories of marketing and holding a team together in indoor football. And it's all coming up for you in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And we have another topic that we really haven't covered much here on Pigskin Dispatch. It's in the realm of football, but it's indoor football and a professional team that existed for a few years, less than half a decade ago. And we have the business manager, Tom Gosch of the Chicago Blitz, joining us today. Tom Gosch, welcome to the Pigpen.
Hey, thank you, Darren. Yeah, it's great to be here. I appreciate it.
Now, Tom, if you don't mind us asking, are you calling from the Chicago area? Is that the area that you live in?
Yeah, I'm still in Chicago, born and raised. So, yeah, I'm in Chicago.
Ah, okay. So, I'm sure a big Bears fan, or maybe you go back to the Cardinals.
No, Bears fan, definitely. Cardinals, no, I'm a little bit too young for that one, but I do know the history. And it was fun when they were in that Super Bowl a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it was even more fun for me because I'm from Western Pennsylvania. But
so, yeah, I could imagine.
we got connected by a mutual friend, Joe Ziemba, who's been on this podcast quite often and is a fellow host here on Sports History Network. And I'm sure you were at one of Joe's many talks on the Cardinals. So he brings some great history to the historic of the gridiron up in that area.
Yeah, it was fun to hear him present because it's not just the Chicago Cardinals. You know, he gets into the Bears and some things that you just didn't really know about, you know, with the history of the Bears. You know George Halas, you know that they struggled in the beginning, but you didn't. He really brought together how much they really struggled on the business side of things, you know, way back in the beginning, the borrowing of the money, the reason why Ditka says that he throws around nickels like manhole covers was because he kind of had to, you know?
Well, I'm sure those are definitely some stories that you can relate to, as we're going to probably discuss here in a few minutes with the position that you had and a very similar position with an indoor team. I guess before we get into that, maybe just to appreciate you as you know, in your football fandom, maybe you could tell us a little bit about your background, how you got involved with football and eventually got the position of being the one of the executives of a major indoor football league.
So I played high school football at just outside of Chicago. There's a western suburb called Franklin Park, Leiden High School. Our claim to fame is Mike Shanahan, the Broncos legendary coach. He played there in the 70s. And so the Shanahans are actually still a part of Franklin Park in the Chicago area. So that's our little claim to fame. And really didn't do much with football until my kids started getting into it. My oldest son wanted to play tackle football. I kind of slowed him down, said, hey, how about some flag football? Get a little experience first. So my first go around was the first day of his flag football experience. You know, one of the coaches that was already there was having a great time with the kids. And I went up and I said, hey, I'd be happy to help you in any way. I played some high school. He's like, oh, we need a head coach. I'm like, no, you don't understand. I'm just here to help. So needless to say, I became a head coach. And since then, three boys played youth football, coached along the way, just the youth football experience. And then when my youngest son stopped, he graduated from youth football, started playing high school, you kind of have to take that step back a little bit. You're not allowed to really coach your kids when they get into high school. And it just so happened that the Chicago Blitz came out of another professional indoor football team called the Chicago Slaughter. Steve McMichael was the head coach of the Slaughter for many years. Jared Payton, Walter Payton's son, played for the team for a while. They played out at the Sears Center out in Hoffman Estates, a pretty nice size indoor stadium. And then what ended up happening was the Slaughter, Steve McMichael was going to be stepping down. So the Slaughter hired Mike Oliver as the head coach, and he put together a team. Then the Slaughter decided to close their doors. As it turns out, you can't have 100 owners that each own 10% of the team. You start, and I'm exaggerating a little bit, but what ended up happening is they started giving out percentages of the team that, you know, equated to way more than 100%, I believe. And so they had to close their doors. They owed some money. So they had to start a new team. The Chicago Blitz was a professional USFL team in the 80s. You guys all probably know that. So in order to get some instant name recognition, the Chicago Blitz name was available. So they went with that. They changed the colors from red, white, red, silver, and blue to more New Orleans Saints colors, black with gold, but the glittery gold, you know, like the Saints, not like your Steelers gold, but the glittery gold. And then they played their first season. They played at the Odeum. It's a smaller place in Villa Park. I wasn't part of the team yet in their first season, but basically Mike Oliver put some money toward it and played the whole season. They ended up getting to the championship of their indoor league. And then the next year is when I needed a job, wanted to look into football, and became an independent contractor and started selling advertising for the Blitz that we're going to be playing in the 2015 season. And they hadn't sold any sponsorship, any advertising or anything. They had sold some tickets. They were basically using all the money out of Mike Oliver's pocket. And that's how I became part of the Blitz. And I sort of noticed, and if you want to interrupt any time, please do. I don't mean to just
I have a question before you get too far out of it. Okay, with the USFL name, that's kind of an interesting subject. It's one of the ones I wanted to ask you. We know, you know, how the new USFL has come out recently here in the last month or so, and there's been some controversy with, I believe, Fox Networks is the main sponsor of, the main owner of the league, and there's some controversy with them using the original USFL names and the team names and some of the colors and logos. And I was just wondering, did they have any, I know you weren't part of the team when they named themselves the Blitz. Did they have any obstruction from anybody challenging the use of the Chicago Blitz name?
No. And I had asked about that. And what they found out was that it wasn't, at the time, it wasn't protected by anything. The copyright, they had somebody look into it, a friend of a friend look into it, and it wasn't copyrighted anymore. So they could use it. And so they did. And we just kind of went from there with it.
Oh, okay. And I think that's sort of what I think Fox's claim is right now, and they're pending suit. I didn't get too much into legalities of it, but I believe that's what they're claiming. There's no copyright on those names and logos, and they're going to use them. So, okay. I just thought that was an interesting subject since you brought it up there.
Yeah, so, definitely.
So I'm sorry, I digress. So you're in the team, you're selling some marketing and getting some sponsorships for them. To tell us about who the major sponsors were for the Blitz? Yeah,
so we figured that football players, they get hurt. So let's get a physical therapist, a team doctor type of thing. So we ended up getting Midwest Orthopedics, who also is the team doctors for the Chicago White Sox, and I think there was one other that they were doing at the time too. So it was kind of great. They became the official team physician of the Chicago Blitz. They paid us a whole bunch of money to do so, and then we had a team doctor that would give the physicals so that we can kind of legitimize everything. And we got our first set of money, you know, after a year and a half being an actual team. And, of course, the football players, that's actually one of the issues that comes up, is that it's football players that try to start a business. And it is a business. Football is a business. You know, when you're doing these things, you've got to have a business plan. You've got to have a business side of things, just like you would if you were starting any type of business. You've got to have marketing. You've got to have, you know, all these different things, because there are plenty of football players out there to field a team, but you got to find the right people to sell the tickets, to put together the group outings, to put together all those different things. And we didn't have that. I became most of all of that. There was a photographer that did a great job of taking pictures of the guys in action, and also for a roster. She was willing to get into it and became our ticket person. So you called her for tickets, like literally her cell phone. And then she would write it on a note and make sure that the tickets were taken care of. Trying to get publicity in all the different areas. Got involved with some of the chambers of commerce to try to get, larger groups to come out. We tried to do some advertising, on the radio and different things like that, just trying to get some free stuff. It's not easy, so we started out with some of the youth football teams. I found a list of some of the youth areas, and especially, with my experience, out in Schaumburg, and just had a youth football day. We had nonprofits are always looking for ways to promote their business. So we did a nonprofit, groups that came out. They put tables around the area so that anybody that was coming could come and see, and then they promoted it. And then they got half of the ticket price to put toward their coffer, just anything. A friend of mine said, how about, inviting some of the different school districts to come out and sing or play the national anthem. So, we had a cello group that came out to do the national anthem, that they brought, 25 of their closest friends to see them in the middle at the 25, it's the 25 yard line in indoor, do that. So anything to get people, to come and sit in the seats.
Yeah, you got to do some real creative marketing, I'm sure, with that. Now they were this is the time frame of like the mid 2014, 2015-ish. Is that the time frame we're in?
Yeah, it was 2014 was their first season. The 2015 was the first season that I had participated in.
Okay, and there's a plethora of indoor football leagues that have sprouted up over the last 20 years or so. What indoor league were they a part of?
I believe they were the Intercontinental Conference. Okay. So there was Saginaw, Michigan, Cleveland, Buffalo. I think there was a team in Atlanta. The other interesting thing is, how do you get these guys there? the Buffalo team came to us They all carpooled. They just took their own cars and drove from Buffalo to play in our game. I was able to conjure up a sponsorship with Windy City Limousine. They got a bus. So our guys got to take a bus to Cleveland and to Saginaw, Michigan. So we were cool. But basically we advertised Windy City on the Dasher boards for in exchange for getting the team to our away games.
Well, that's a pretty cool little trade off there. Definitely helps. Now, how did you get to Atlanta, though? I'm sure that's a pretty long bus ride to get to Atlanta.
Well, it's amazing because we never did get to Atlanta. The Atlanta team, by the time we had to play them, ended up folding. So that, and you know, that was kind of an interesting one too, where, you know, we advertise something and then we don't actually have the game. So made it difficult. And what really ends up happening is, you know, it was a player coach that was owner. So we got our first, you know, $5,000 or $6,000, and I was hoping we could put something toward marketing, you know, make sure that we can pay the venue for, you know, playing the games there. And here's a funny story. The Pittsburgh indoor team, the Arena Football League, they were the same colors as the Pittsburgh Steelers, so black and gold, not the gold like we wanted to be originally. We had the uniforms, you know, that were perfect, that, you know, that
the canary yellow color.
Yeah, the canary yellow. Thank you. I figured a Steeler fan would know exactly what it was. So it turns out that the Pittsburgh indoor team was getting rid of their uniforms and we ended up buying them. So there goes our, you know, coffer of, you know, $6,000 so that we can get these colors. And even worse than that, talk about a bad business decision. It's a different color gold. So we've been doing everything with this, making it look, you know, like the Saints gold. And now I suddenly have to make it canary gold. And so there's, you know, it just was crazy. I know we had perfectly good uniforms. It just turned out that I think there was a pink stripe that went across them because of one away game the year that I wasn't part of it. And so some of the guys didn't like that the white jerseys had a pink stripe on them because of something that, you know, was painted on the, it was insane. It was pretty crazy.
And I guess if you're buying jerseys from another team, how do you remove the logos? Aren't those sort of like embossed on there or silk screened on there, or are they just patches?
They didn't have logos, and we didn't have logos on ours too. The only logos we had were on our helmets. We got the logos on our helmets, and otherwise it was just a general jersey, you know.
Well that's pretty convenient then. Works out well. I'm sitting here thinking, you know, it says, you know, the Pittsburgh across the front or something, and you had to change that to Chicago. I'm thinking, boy, that must have been pretty tricky.
It just was regular plain old stuff. So I guess, you know, at some point you start to save some money some way, you know, doing some things, doing it that way. So, another thing that really kind of helped us and sparked us a little bit was we had a gal who was one of the dancers for the Slaughter. And she kept trying to contact me about putting together Chicago Blitz dancers. And, you know, I got enough problems, you know, I'm trying to figure out this situation. Are we at the Odeon? What colors are we, logo, you know, all these other things. And now she wants to come at me with these Blitz dancers. Finally, we have a meeting and she's got great ideas. You know, she'll do a tryout for, you know, these Blitz dancers. All the dancers have their friends that come to the games, you know, and you know, they'll all pay and everything like that. And basically, it's a great thing to get the whole family involved because the Blitz dancers are going to be there. So we put together a dance crew. She did a great job of putting together some great music and dancing. And then I'll call them girls because they were young girls, I guess. they would go to some of the different things with the players and, you know, come meet the Blitz dancers and our players at, you know, this networking event. And, you know, kids were there and everything. It really turned out to be a great idea.
Wow, that's interesting, because you don't see that like too much in the pro teams. Other than the Dallas Cowboys, you really don't hear of the successes of the young ladies that are, you know, cheerleaders. I know there's probably a handful of teams that have cheerleaders, but really the Dallas Cowboys are the only ones that have had any success that you really know about, at least
right.
the general public knows about. So it's an interesting concept.
I have to say that we did get one person into the NFL from the Chicago Blitz, and that was Jen, who started the Blitz Dancers. She was a Bengal cheerleader for 2 years.
Nice.
So the Cincinnati Bengals have the Bengals, and she was one of them for a couple of years. So there's our claim to fame right there.
Yeah, I know a lot of the ladies are very interested in the cheerleaders. My mother lives in the Dallas area, and last year we had the opportunity. We hadn't seen her for a couple of years because of COVID. So my family, my daughter, my wife, and I, we traveled down there to visit my mother. And one of the things that my wife told my mother is that she wanted to tour AT&T Stadium. And my wife knows very little about football, but she loves the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders and watches their program that they have of making their squad every year. She's addicted to that reality show. So that one of the things, and of course it benefited me because I got to, you know, I'm a football fan. I'm not a Cowboys fan, but I got to tour AT&T Stadium, you know, State of Art Stadium. And they have a tour where they take you everywhere. You're in the locker room of the Cowboys, the visitor's locker. You go through the cheerleaders locker room and see, you know, all their lockers. And it's really kind of interesting, but that was a big highlight in it. So cheerleaders do bring people to the stands. And actually my wife has me looking right now to see if there's tickets to any Cowboys game, because she wants to go see the Cowboys cheerleaders perform. She couldn't care less about the game, but she wants to see the cheerleaders. So they do sell tickets, the cheerleaders.
Yeah.
Do.
Yeah. So yeah, it turned out to be, you know, a great idea. We ended up being able to pay the girls too, per game. The guys got paid per game. Basically, the way it worked out, the ticket sales would actually pay for the day. If we could get enough people to come and pay, it paid for not the rental. The rental came from all of the sponsorships and things like that, but to pay the players and, you know, all the different things that happened, the ticket sales ended up paying for that. So it was pretty good. It was pretty good in that respect.
So it's a pretty decent business plan to work out. You know where your monies are coming from and what they're going to. Now, what was the structure of the pay of the Blitz? You know, was it like a flat fee? Every player gets the same amount, or do the star players get a little bit more? I've seen a couple different levels of development in the pay structures, and it's kind of interesting to pay attention to some of that.
Yeah, the league itself had their structure, and you couldn't deviate it too far from it officially. So officially, you know, if you were the quarterback, I think it was $200 a game. If you were, you know, a running back or a receiver, it was $150 a game. Any of the linemen, you know, was $125 a game or something like that. So it did, the bigger you were, is the way I said it, the less money you made, based on, your position there. So, you know what though, these guys that are playing, I mean, they loved getting paid. It was great for them, but they're at a point where they played in college in most cases. And they just wanted to keep playing. They had real jobs. They got to go to travel. Guys, there's groupies too, you know, that follow all that indoor stuff, and they know every player. They knew, there were people that were fans of the Blitz that knew the players better than I did. Their names, their positions, you know, where they went to college, everything like that. And, you know, they've really got into it.
You know, it's really kind of interesting. I was going to ask you about this. So it's mostly local players working day jobs, playing football and picking up a couple extra bucks as a side gig. It really takes you back to what we alluded to earlier with, you know, George Halas and how he had to put, and the rest of the coaches around the early NFL, how they had to put teams together for the, probably the first four decades, where guys in the off season and when they weren't playing on Sunday, they had to do a day job to make ends meet. So kind of a neat parallel.
Yeah, it's exactly the case. And sometimes, you know, something came up and your star, you know, wide receiver couldn't make a game, you know, and you got to, you know, figure out a way who's going to take over that position. It's interesting. And you mentioned local. You try to be as local as possible because it's less expensive. So, you know, one of the stories that I love to tell is they had a guy, they were doing their tryouts and they were doing it over, you know, I think a 2-week period. Every evening they were practicing at the Odeum. They were kind of trying to dwindle down from, let's say 75 guys to a roster of, you know, maybe 30. I can't remember the actual numbers. So, Tom, we got this guy. He lives out of town. We need to put him up for the 2 weeks. You know, okay, all right, well, let's figure this out. So I did some business networking, and there was a hotel, a Holiday Inn near the Odeum. And so I worked out a deal where they could, you know, advertise in our program, you know, in exchange for keeping this guy for 2 weeks. All we had to do was pay $25 a night for the cleaning, because they couldn't cover that. But the rest of it was part of this exchange. And, you know, the hotel staff fell in love with them. Great guy. I actually end up using, because he was a guy from last year, I end up using his picture of him, you know, catching this one-handed thing for pretty much everything, you know, when we're advertising it. Turns out he didn't make the team. They had to cut him at the last cut. He didn't make the team. I'm like, really? This is our guy. We put money into this guy. We got him on everything, and he couldn't even find one spot for him on the team. So, you know, that's just one of those things where the business side and the player side doesn't always work out.
I thought you were going to sort of end it with, you know, I'm not a wide receiver, but last night I stayed at a Holiday Inn Express or something.
Right, yeah. Catch line on. Yeah. 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 They had to be the official. It actually worked out pretty good for the hotel too, because you know, if a team came from out of town, if they were staying, you know, we would recommend that they stay there, you know, and you know, so those were some of the kind of the ways is to kind of get through it is, to just have some sponsorship in exchange for, you know, things that we needed and
barter and trade system.
Exactly. So it was good for the team to have kind of a business person behind it, because it survived longer than it would have otherwise, I think. Not saying that it was all on me, but just having some type of, you know, business behind it really helped it survive, because quite honestly, I actually ended up, it was a 1099 contract position. I wasn't on staff, or, you know, I didn't have a salary or anything like that. I ended up getting a real job, and I was still going to help them out a little bit, but something came up. The weekend before their first game the next year, I actually had an emergency my appendix taken out. So I couldn't help them as much as I could. I thought I could. And they didn't even last the season. They didn't have, you know, that business background or someone doing that can just kind of keep them in line to make sure that, you know, the place that they played got paid, you know, all the vendors got paid, you know, make sure that the sponsors were happy with their logos on everything, and, you know, just kind of, you know, doing it all over again.
So when you were prior to that season, when you were active in doing all the business transactions for the team, was that a side job for you, or was that a full-time gig for you that year?
Well, it was a full-time gig, but it should have been the idea, and the reason why you see a lot of young people in some of the minor league teams, you know, baseball or football or anything, is that, you know, there's not a lot of money in it. You know, there really isn't. If you're a player, there's not obviously a couple hundred bucks a game. And then if you're, you know, unless it's really a league that is, you know, paid for by, you know, the NFL, like we've got a D League Chicago Bulls that play out by us. And everything is supported. If they lose money because nobody goes to a game, it's still supported by the Bulls, you know, the Chicago Bulls. So no one's not getting paid. No one's, you know, it's all, you know, part of their program. With this, if there's not money coming in, you're not getting paid. And, you know, that anyway, so it was my full-time job while I was looking for something that was a full-time job. Quite
gotcha. Gotcha. I was just wondering, you're, so you were almost in a similar predicament as the players were in the cheerleaders, where you were, you know, trying to make ends meet and trying to enjoy the game of football from your jobs that you were doing with that team. So, extremely interesting. Now, did you travel with the team when they went to like Cleveland and Buffalo and places elsewhere?
I didn't, just merely because there's no room, you know, enough to make, you know, make sure that the players had enough room on the bus. We did have, you know, the photographer went, and so that she, they, that's the thing. That's what's wild is the players love the pictures that would be taken. Like every team needed to have a photographer. And it was sort of in the beginning of Facebook becoming something that is a little bit more, you know, regular in 2015, 2014. So having that presence on social media was incredible. And having the pictures on there was that the players loved it. They would have played for free just to have awesome pictures of them. They didn't even care that we were streaming live. Which wasn't really happening in 2015. So we had a YouTube live that we would show for away games. And we had a deal with one of the local broadcast colleges to broadcast the game. So we had guys that were broadcasting for free just to put something on tape and, you know, be able to, you know, a couple of guys, one guy is the broadcaster for Purdue. I think he does Purdue radio for Purdue football. And then he also does some minor league baseball teams. He was one of our broadcasters and I can't think of his name off the top of my head. I think last name was Cole. So kind of interesting.
Yeah. Now I don't know if this is I think this might be a good time to do it. Now you were telling us and I'll segue this in here, but you have a clip that you shared with me before we came on and started recording, and just to show what a jack of all trades that Tom is, Tom actually did the promo commercial for his team, the Chicago Blitz, which he's going to play for us right now.
Chicago Blitz professional indoor football returns to the Odeum in Villa Park for its second season, March 29, 2015. Come watch as they take on the Buffalo Lightning, Cleveland Saints, Atlanta Sharks, and last year's rival, Saginaw Sting. Tickets start at just $10. Get your tickets for all Blitz home games by going online to chicagoblitzfootball.com or calling 630-465-5659. Group and season tickets also available. Chicago Blitz, family, fun, and football, baby! Woo!
I can feel the enthusiasm. I'm ready to go to the game, coach. Put me in.
How about it? Hey, and I don't think the website or the phone number works anymore. So none of your listeners should call or go to those websites. It might still work. I'm not sure. But yeah, and what happened, I put together some pictures from the previous season to make it kind of a commercial that you can also do on TV. And, you know, we put together, you know, schedules, you know, for to put in bars. So I actually figured out a way to have Miller Lite print up some schedules for some posters. And so that got out to some of the local bars in the western suburbs of Chicago. It didn't really generate much, but it was still kind of cool, you know, to walk into a bar and see the Chicago Blitz schedule there. And that actually, about 2 years ago, I went into a bar and the thing was still there. So kind of fun.
Yeah. Some, maybe a memento that might be worth some money someday. You know, who knows?
About it.
People collecting everything. That's for sure. Now, now you, what did you said you took another job. Did you stay in a professional sports arena, or did you go back into the business world?
Went back into the business world. I've always been in sales. So I found a sales job that I'm still in now. I tried to stick around. I did do the stadium announcing for the Chicago home games. I used to be a DJ back in the day for weddings and things, so I can turn on. You heard my voice.
Yeah, I was gonna say maybe got in the realm of doing promos for, you know, radio shows and television.
No, that was, I went to college for that. I just couldn't, I ended up just getting into sales, so I didn't have to really, you know, worry about my voice then, but I had offered to continue doing the stadium announcing for the Blitz as I was working at this other job. And like I said, the first game, I ended up having my appendix taken out. I was still recovering after the second game. And quite honestly, I don't think it lasted the third game of the third season. So, it just kind of fell apart.
Now,
I think happened, and I wasn't all part privy to all that, but they ended up changing leagues. And then the league that they went to, the officiating was a little bit suspect. I think they were, you know, going back to the original days of George Halas. I think that the officials were taking money from multiple sides, and it just became more of a indoor fight than an indoor football game. And I was listening to some of the games because we still had the broadcast contract, and it did seem like they were a little bit more chippy than they were previously, illegal hits and things like that. And I think at some point, you know, these guys want to play football. They don't want to kill themselves, you know, playing for $150 or something like that. So that's why they ended up stopping operations.
That's too bad. I'm a former high school official. I officiated Wore the Stripes for 27 years. So I'm sad to hear that the officials were part of the downfall of the league. Now, I guess we hear so much about, we've had so many upstart leagues that, you know, not only indoor and arena, but, you know, outdoor regular 11 man football as well over the past decade or so. And what is sort of the feeling? Now, I know you weren't there for those final three games very much because of your illness and taking another job, but was there some, like, could you hear the drum beat the season prior to that you knew maybe something was coming up? And are you always looking over your shoulder if the, you know, the hatchet man's coming to take the season down?
I think what it really came down to, it's not me personally, but just if you're going to do something like this, you've got to have that business side of things. You've got to have that business plan, budgeting, you know, for, you know, not having these, going out and getting uniforms, you know, making sure that all of your expenses are covered. And that's one of the interesting parts of Joe's presentation when he was talking about the Bears and the Cardinals, is that there was a showing of how much they paid each player, how much the arena cost and everything like that. You've got to have those numbers, and you got to have to go into it beforehand, knowing what you have to expect. So how many people do you have to expect to be there paying $10 a pop in order to pay the players? How many sponsors do you need to have for the course of the year? If you're charging $3,000 for the year, how many of those do you need in order to pay for, you know, the location? That's the part I think gets lost in any of these upstarts, is the business side of things. Because the reason why they're getting started is that there's probably a player that wants to continue playing and, you know, wants to, you know, continue the way that it once was and doesn't have that business acumen to get it, to keep it rolling. And I think one of the reasons why I think the USFL might continue better than it did in the 80s is because they've got a business plan that they know. They've got the rights on Fox and some of the other broadcasts, that if nobody goes to the games, it's okay because all of their, it's all paid for by the, you know, by the TV revenue. And so they know exactly how much each person can get paid. So you're not going to have a Herschel Walker or somebody that's going to blow everything out of the water. And then all of a sudden some other team's got to get their splash. And they, if they stick to that and make it that particular type of league and everybody gets paid a certain amount the way, you know, based on their performance, then it could last a long time. But if you do get somebody that's going to come and make a bit, try to make this big splash, that's what's going to be the downfall.
Now, before this version of the USFL was announced, we had a gentleman on from a project. It's a social media group called the USFL Project. I'm not sure if you're familiar with their, they're fans, super fans of the original USFL that happened in 1980s. And he told me in this interview I did with him, the original innovator of the USFL actually happened in the 1960s, and the AFL's rise to power sort of eliminated his ability to do that because there was so much publicity for the AFL and the NFL. But his original plan was to have a spring league only and to pay, have a flat fee for the players and not deviate from it. And everybody pay those, all their players the same, which seems to be what this current USFL is doing, following that exact plan that was set forth in the 1960s.
I remember that too. I'm not familiar specifically with that, but I know that that's what the USFL was supposed to be. And then all of a sudden it became like the AFL, you know, where Joe Namath comes out, let's sign this guy for X amount. Herschel Walker, I think, was the one who, you know, had the big splash with the New Jersey Generals back at the time. That's what's going to be the downfall if that happens. I love spring football. I love watching the USFL. You know, I'm not a basketball guy, and that's all that's on. And I don't know about you, but watching the last 2 minutes of a basketball game is excruciating to me because it just stops and timeouts and fouls and things like that. Football, man, it's just whether it's played by, you know, the Chicago Bears or the NFL or the USFL or even some indoor stuff, you know, you still, if you're watching the offensive and defensive line, you know, it's tough no matter what, you know, no matter what division you're looking at. So it's always fun to me.
Yeah. I got a couple more questions, and maybe, and you tell me if you don't want to answer them or not. You talked a little bit about your opinion on the USFL. I think you like the way that their business plan model is going so far and what they're doing. But there's two other leagues that are going to be starting here in the next 10 months, outdoor 11-man leagues. Do you mind if I ask you questions on what your opinion is on them from your expert opinion from being in that walk of life?
Sure.
Okay, I guess first of all, we have the reincarnation of the XFL, the third go around the XFL, this time with Dwayne The Rock Johnson and his partner. I believe her name is Dana Garcia. I'm not sure what they're doing with their players. I think they might be playing players at different escalations. But they have, again, they have a TV contract. I believe ABC and that whole ESPN group has contracts on the television. So they've got some revenue coming that way. And, you know, you have the media presence of Dwayne The Rock Johnson, who's probably the most popular guy in Hollywood right now, and all the movies. So, you know, you got some good money going on there. What's your opinion of what you know about the XFL coming up for the spring of 2023?
You know, again, if they stick to their business game plan, I think everybody can play very well in the sandbox. I obviously, you get that football is a very popular sport. The NFL is very popular, and I think people, if you really love watching football, you know, they're going to watch some of this other stuff. You got to give it a chance, and you've got to stick to that business plan and make sure that everybody gets paid so that it can continue. So I think the XFL can work nicely with the USFL. I think it can all work very nicely with the NFL. I think what you see from the XFL in the olden days, some of that, the camera work that the NFL uses now was stolen from the XFL when it was being used. I think the USFL is using drones. That's kind of cool to watch that happen. And the camera that's above the field on the pulleys and everything, you know, that's just like watching a video, watching a video game. So they get to try some of this stuff because why not? And the NFL can then use it and, you know, put a lot more money into it, and everyone's happy.
Yeah, there's some really neat things. I know the USFL is using, I believe, laser and GPS on their down and distance chains and chips in the football to tell if right away if there's a first down or not. And Mike Pereira is the head of officiating for the USFL, bringing some of these concepts. You know, that'll probably, if it works, leak into the NFL one of these coming years, I'm sure.
I think in most cases, more is better. I mean, look at baseball. You know, you've got all of these minor leagues teams that have popped up. If you can get the kids to go to or watch some of these, and it's less expensive than going to, you know, an NFL game or a major league game, you know, you get more people that get exposed to it being, well, live and also just being around. I think it'll become more popular overall.
Yeah. Now I told you there was another league coming up, and they're going to be another spring league, and they are the Major League of Football. And our friend John Davis was just on a couple weeks ago. He is one of the, I'm not sure what his exact position is, but he's going to be setting up a lot of the preseason and the training camps and tryouts for the league. And they're going to actually, traditionally, they're going to be a spring league, but they're going to be a developmental league. They're advertising themselves as developmental league for players to move on and play in these bigger leagues, the NFL, the CFL, you know, possibly the USFL and XFL, should that merit. But they want to train players, coaches, executives, cheerleaders, everything to be able to compete and be the best that they can be to go up to these upper levels. And what they did is they invested heavily. They ended up buying the AAF's all their equipment, not only the player equipment, but all of the technology and headsets and everything else that the AAF had what they use for their two or three game season that they had for their existence of their league. And they are going to be having a mini season here this fall, which is kind of interesting. They're having tryouts in July, and I think they're going to be playing at, unlike the USFL where they're playing all at one venue, they're going to be playing at four different venues. They have four teams coming out, and I know one's in Ohio, one's in, I think, Arkansas, one's in Texas, and escapes me where the fourth team is. But they're going to end up having this team develop these players a short season here in the fall, and then have a regular season, possibly with six or eight teams next year, but playing a pretty much a flat fee, more structured to the way that you're familiar with the indoor arena league type format that they're doing. So what's your opinion on that?
I'm all for it. I think it'd be great. There's also a hidden personal aspect to it. One of my sons plays Division II college football at Upper Iowa University. He's been a starter for 3 years. He graduated, but he's sticking around because of a COVID year. He made all conference last year a league that has Minnesota State, has Winona State, and some players that have come out of that league have played in the NFL and have gotten drafted. So if he loves the sport, he's 6'6", 320-pound offensive lineman. He started at center for 2 years. He started at tackle last year and will probably continue playing left tackle. And he's got the body. He's got the willingness. And if he can take advantage of some of these stepping stones, I think it'd be great for the sport, along with guys like him that want to try to keep playing. Hey, when you're 21, 22, 23 years old, you know, you don't have that much responsibility, really. Try to get into the NFL. You play a couple of years there, even at a league minimum, and you're generally set for life, you know? So,
yeah. So if he gets the opportunity, I know they're having tryouts around the country. I believe their website is MLFB.com. So maybe that's an opportunity for folks like your son that still want to play some ball and maybe have that chance to make it to the big leagues.
Yeah. Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
As you know,
Tom, I appreciate your time here. I know our time's limited today, and it's very interesting to hear that aspect of your experience in indoor football and, you know, basically running a team from the business side and giving us our opinions on some of these upstart leagues. And we really appreciate you being on today and sharing with us.
Sounds great. I appreciate being on. It's kind of going down memory lane is always a good time. So, yeah, anytime I could talk football or answer any questions you have, give me a call.
I certainly will. And you have an open invite anytime you have something that you'd like to discuss with us here on Pigskin Dispatch. So thank you, Tom.
We're taking a peek over at the chains and the down marker. It's fourth and long. We're going to have to punt the ball and get on out of here, but we'll have another series tomorrow for your football history headlines, so be sure to tune in. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast. PigskinDispatch.com is a proud affiliate of the Sports History Network, the headquarters of sports yesteryear.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.